We're back with the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I are talking with Kevin Phillips. When you say republic with a small r, that is not an inconsequential category in the world at large, looking back or looking forward. And you're a political analyst. This business of republic with a small r is a very big notion in the world, isn't it?
Well, most of the countries today are republics. But that certainly wasn't true at the time the United States came into being. It was deemed to be an anomaly, a republic. You'd have had them in Florence and some other places. Corsica tried to be one. The Dutch and the Swiss had done it. But basically, that was not the shape of a polity. And as late as the American Civil War, a lot of people in Britain believed that the American democracy was a fluke, which happily could be destroyed if the Confederacy succeeded in breaking away, that the North American Republic would dissolve. So it's an unusual thing, and that's why to trace it back was in itself sort of different.
Saying that, you mentioned somewhere in the course of your recent book,
The Cousins Wars,
that there is a place in the Library of Congress for alternate histories.
Oh, we were fascinated.
Just a fascinating idea, and I think we've already sent several people on their way.
They may never be the same.
But it is striking to look at that, and at the same time, maybe we should back up. Your premise is that these three wars had a great deal in common. The sources and the outcomes all were intertwined in some very important ways. The tendency sometimes is to think about the inevitability of history. And the other extreme, of course, is to think about the randomness of history. And if you take this Library of Congress section, then that sort of tries to deal with, you know, where those two
kinds of fanciful what-ifs.
If somebody had done something or not done something, if timing had been different, and you cover lots of those circumstances. But that dichotomy between the inevitability and the seeming randomness of history, in working through this, did you try to resolve that?
Well, I'm a believer in the interrelation of the two. I think an awful lot of the circumstances can be traced and be organized, and that things are not, in a very basic way, just flukishly aligned. But there always is an element of fluke, and there is an element of luck. And wars and campaigns and battles will give you that in Technicolor. But I had a very nerve-wracking example with my first book 30-some years ago called The Emerging Republican Majority. Now, it looked to me like a pretty good bet as I started on it. But on the election night of 1968, that election was not settled until 2 o'clock in the morning.
And there went your future.
And there hung the future of that book, and in a sense, you know, what I was going to do.
Yeah.
So that was one like Gettysburg or Saratoga that could have, by some yardsticks, gone either way. Mm-hmm. So to make history work the way the little marbles were supposed to work, you had to have some luck, too.
And some forethought. And one of the things I found really remarkable in the Cousins Wars was how many things I just plain learned. Now, I hope you're right about them. I hope what I learned was correct. But this sense of, I guess I would ask you to say, what are the continuities within this general theme that they are small our republics?
Well, let me give you the continuities quickly, because that's one of them. That all three of these wars, the English Civil War, the American Revolution, and the American Civil War, were won by, either temporarily or in the longer framework or both, by the side that was Democratic with a small d and Republican with a small r, and represented a more quote-unquote progressive version of history. But you also find that the side represented by the middle class one, the side that was urban, the side that represented more of the marketplace and less of the old way of doing things economically, and usually the side that was low church as opposed to high church. Now, these are all simplifications, but there's all an unfolding pattern in which they play a role.
John Keegan, and I think lots of others, talk about the First War and the Second War as essentially being variation. I mean, the Second War is an extension of what happened in the First War.
John Keegan being an historian of war.
Right. In some ways, and certainly the way you present it, it almost appears that each of these wars, for all they were spread out over centuries, is part of a larger conflict, that every now and then the tensions would get so great, and I think it's Keegan that says, when the values get badly enough out of alignment, war is inevitable. And in some sense, just working through this the way you present it, it appears that, you know, there's this centuries-long aligning and realigning and realigning, each one of which is punctuated in very substantial ways and moved, and the process is moved forward in substantial ways by those wars.
I think that's right, and it's a theory and a realization that I came to about three-quarters of the way through, and thank God for word processors. And you can re-flavor everything with your chocolate chips. You don't have to settle for plain vanilla. And the way that that worked, I think, was that within the framework of the English-speaking peoples, there was this stream which eventually prevailed that was more democratic, more adventuresome, more entrepreneurial, away from the high church thought process, not wrapped up with monarchy. And it spread across the Atlantic, and it spread across the United States, and it won the battles. Now, that's the continuity over these centuries. But there's another relationship that these wars were ladders arising out of each other, in the sense that in the American Revolution, New England, which was really the cockpit of it, the people that were the most agitated, the earliest, took an awful lot of that agitation from memories of the English Civil War. Then by the time we reached the American Civil War, the whole slavery question and the division of the United States between North and South, slave and free, had really been laid down right after the American Revolution in the whole debate over the Constitution. So these wars, in another way, in terms of a framework, set each other up, too.
Well, there is, by implication, the going forward part that maybe some of these ongoing conflicts are not resolved now.
Now, that's a critical question, because I think that we are in many ways out of this framework now, but the framework is still important, and we have a party system which no longer draws on these wartime alignments. The party system we had when we were growing up was the Civil War party system, but when it reversed, you wound up with a Republican Party stronger in the South and a Democratic Party stronger in New England, the old Puritan area.
Which is just a flip.
Reversed it. And I think that we really don't have a party system now that has any strong basis in anything, but you have a lot of these cultural fights are lingering on, and politics doesn't handle them very well.
The metaphor that we used for a long time with respect to the United States was the melting pot. People came from all over the world and became Americans. And again, looking at the detailed representation of the flows of people from Europe to this country, I had a much clearer sense of this as geological stratification that sustained over centuries, and again, going well back into Europe.
It certainly goes back into Europe, but it especially goes back into Protestant Europe, because the British crown in the 18th century was actually at that point in the hands of Germans. In the end of the...
I think we forget that.
The Hanoverians, whose names live on in a lot of East Coast towns and counties, Frederick, Augusta, George, Chatham, Prime Minister Pitt, and so forth. But what you got out of all this was just a very difficult framework to explain away without reference to these lingering ethnic patterns, because the Britain of the 18th century was the melting pot, the Ellis Island of Protestant refugees from Europe. And those are the people that came to 17th and 18th century North America, French Huguenots, Germans, Scotch-Irish, Scots, Welsh, no Italians, no Yugoslavs. You were looking at essentially the Protestant refugees. And parts of Great Britain had towns and neighborhoods that were French Huguenot or Flemish or Dutch, and they were a melting pot in a small way themselves. And we did not originate this. This originated in the British Empire of the 17th and 18th century, and America took a legacy out of that.
It is tough to overestimate, in my reading of your book, The Cousins' Wars, the importance of the Protestant Reformation, that we are still hearing that bell ring.
Well, I think so. It was a very, very central phenomenon in everything that happened in Europe in the 16th and 17th centuries. Still very important in the 18th and still surprisingly important in the 19th. And I remember in the 1960 presidential election when the first Catholic won, going back and looking at the voting patterns, and you could find in some of the Midwestern areas Catholic rural counties where the Democrats gained 30 points, and they were right next to a Swedish or Southern Baptist area where the Democrats lost 6 or 8, still around.
Yeah, still that religious flavor.
You talk about, I'm almost tempted to say an unholy troika, that is religion and politics and war. And the interrelationship between those, again, as these stratus flow, as the Protestants move from one place to another, the relationship in a political environment, the richness of that relationship and the dynamism of that is just fascinating.
Let's do that when we come back. We're going to take a quick break. We are talking with Kevin Phillips. Bill Russell and I invite you to return with us when we come back in a moment.